Where are the children today on the world? I'm Carol Hills. President Trump's executive order yesterday ended his policy of splitting families at the border, but thousands of kids who've already been separated from their parents are still in limbo, and legal groups trying to help them aren't even sure where they are.
I am largely staffed by lawyers and social workers, and right now they're behaving like private investigators because they're just trying to connect the dots and figure out where these people are.
Also, students explore MIT's historical connection to slavery with an eye to race relations today.
The current climate is directly linked to the history that we come from, and we can't separate the two.
Plus, a fictional aging rocker makes a comeback.
You know, they say, write about what you know, and what I know is I'm getting older.
Those stories ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. The policy of separating families who arrive at the U.S. border without documents is history. It was part of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration stance. But yesterday, President Trump backtracked, signing an executive order to end the policy going forward. But the order still leaves the fate of thousands of immigrant kids already separated from their families in limbo. And it seems the government has no clear process for tracking families once they're split up or for reuniting them. Immigration lawyers and nonprofits have been trying to fill the void. A group called KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, is one of those organizations. Wendy Young is the president of KIND. Wendy, at this point, as far as you know, does the government have any plan on how to reunite these kids with their parents?
No, it's pretty evident to us that they did not plan for this at all, which is why KIND and a lot of our colleague organizations are trying to step into that void and see what we can do.
And what is your organization, KIND, doing to reunite these kids and their parents?
Well, we actually have programming on the ground in Central America that we do with local NGO partners there. And we are identifying parents who've actually already been deported and their child left behind the United States in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. We are working with those parents to try and contact the U.S. government officials through the hotline that they set up to see if we can, you know, reconnect the parent to the child. The problem with the hotline is that it's barely functioning, if functioning at all. Bottom line, what you're hearing here is we are engaging in very convoluted systems ourselves that we are, frankly, making up as we go along in order to try and facilitate contact that the U.S. government should have thought through and done itself on behalf of these families if they were going to take this drastic step of separating them after arrival.
Now, you mentioned trying to connect kids who have been detained up here with their parents back in Central America, but aren't there also a lot of cases of trying to reunite kids who are in detention or at one of these camps with their parents who are also detained, but somewhere else here
in
the U.S.?
Yes, that's right. That's right. What's happened here, after the family is separated, after arrival at the border, the parents are being criminally prosecuted, put into the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service, prosecuted and then transferred to ICE and Customs Enforcement for further detention. These are completely different facilities from the facilities that the children have been placed in. The children have been redesignated as unaccompanied and placed into one of the ORR facilities that traditionally are used for children who truly arrive alone at the border without a parent or legal guardian. And what happens at that point is the parents' case is on one legal track, first for the criminal prosecution and then for the deportation. And the child's case has been bifurcated and is treated as a second case.
So effectively, you have government departments like ICE and Office for Refugee Resettlement working at cross purposes.
That's correct. And in the best of days, federal agencies aren't particularly good at communicating with each other. Their databases are very antiquated. They don't link up. They don't talk to each other. So now adding this policy that was, you know, very ill thought out, very quickly implemented, impacting thousands of people, is just an incredible challenge to try and figure this all out.
When, a parent and child shows up at the border or is captured after they've crossed the border illegally, what sort of data is recorded about that incident that you're then able to follow up on to try to reunite them once they're separated?
Well, we would not have access to the data on the parent. That would be CBP data. And the government would not share that with us.
What's CBP?
Customs and Border Protection.
One sort of wonders, well, isn't there kind of data that's put down or information about a particular that then
absolutely.
Allows you to reconnect people.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, some of that data eventually, if the parent is able to locate legal counsel, the legal counsel may be able to go backwards and access that data from Border Patrol. But for the purposes you're talking about, for family reunification, that data wouldn't be available to us.
Have you been able to reunite any kids and parents so far? I know it's been a short period of time, but any success stories so far?
Not yet, no.
Wendy Young is president of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, a group involved in reuniting kids and parents who've been separated after entering the U.S. border. Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you.
Reaction to the family separation policy has been fierce and widespread this week. Among other things, several major U.S. airlines say they're no longer willing to transport migrant children separated from their families by the U.S. government. The airlines include United, American, and Frontier. Hunt Palmquist is a flight attendant based in Dallas. He says he works for a major airline, but his employer's policies prohibit him from saying which one. Palmquist says in recent weeks he's been on two flights with immigrant children who've been separated from their parents.
Flight attendants are all well-trained and well-versed in human trafficking, child trafficking. And on the San Antonio flight, it just didn't look quite right. There were five children dressed in what looked like Walmart gray sweatsuits. There were escorts who I didn't talk to, but I looked at the faces of the children, and they seemed upset. And yet their faces, they looked like they were shut down. I'm a pretty good judge of what's going on. And there was sadness in their eyes, and they looked very exhausted.
Let's talk about the other flight you worked on to McAllen, Texas. Tell us about that experience.
The children ranged in age from 4 to 11 years old.
Did you talk to the kids?
I tried to in my own Spanglish, and they didn't reply to me. From what I understand from sharing with other flight attendants from different airlines, the children are silent. I don't know if they're told to be silent or if they're just so shut down. There was a child who was about 4 or 5 years old. His face was like stone, but tears were running down his cheeks, and you could tell his chin was moving a little bit, and excuse me, it's kind of emotional.
It's okay.
But it was almost like, how can I describe it? Silent tears. And the tears were just running down his face, and he wasn't moving. And I'll never forget that face.
Were you able to talk with the people sitting with these kids to find out where they were going or anything about them?
Yes. I talked to the agent, the ICE agent, and he said that they were taking the children to relocation camps and that they had been separated from their parents.
Did he say anything else about how long they'd be separated or what kind of place they were being taken to?
I did talk to him, and I said, this is really a horrible thing. And he said, I agree. And I didn't know how somebody could have a job like that, you know.
So this was an ICE agent who was also surprised and a little uncomfortable about the policy.
Yes, he thought it wasn't a good policy.
What do your coworkers say about their own experience on these kind of flights?
Well, I've heard a number of different stories. The one that really comes to mind is a flight attendant had children on board. He was told that they were a soccer team, and it just didn't sound right to this friend of mine, this flight attendant, and he said, what's really going on here? And then the agent, escort, admitted to him they were immigrant children being sent for relocation.
So if you get on a flight, if you report for work and get on a flight and find out there are kids being transported who've been separated from their families, what do you plan to do?
Well, first I'll talk to the crew, talk to the captain. He's in charge. And will inform them that I am unable to be a collaborator in their transport.
Are you saying you'll leave that flight?
Yeah, I won't be able to accept the assignment. I'll be unable to participate in that kind of transport of these poor kids. And you know, as an American, this isn't the America I grew up in, you know.
Hunt Palmquist is a flight attendant based in Dallas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has been sending out mixed messages on the reasons for the policy change on separating families. Some have said it's just about following the law. Others have suggested it's about discouraging undocumented immigration. Many critics say that's definitely what it's about. Anna Altman has been looking into immigration deterrence strategies in other countries. She's a PhD candidate in political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Detention, I think, is the big one that refugee rights advocates are really worried about. Australia has an across-the-board policy of detaining people who arrive, even if they're applying for asylum, by boat. A lot of countries in Europe also have policies of detention, and obviously the United States does too. Another type of policy would be something that decreases the likelihood that you're successful in applying for asylum. So in 2016, the EU made a deal with Turkey that had a number of components to reduce asylum seeking, but one of them was that if you're caught trying to enter the EU illegally through Greece, you will basically be put on a blacklist and unable to receive resettlement, even if you have a credible claim to refugee status later on. Certainly that would count as a form of deterrence.
What about immigration deterrence policies generally? What's the evidence that they work or don't work in reducing illegal immigration?
There isn't much empirical evidence that deterrence policies work, and there are a lot of logical reasons to think that it wouldn't. So something like the EU-Turkey deal that I mentioned before, folks will argue that it's working because since 2016, crossings through the Aegean Sea have definitely decreased, but it's hard to say if that is because of a deterrent effect or because of increased border enforcement, so more people are simply being caught. And it's also the case that during that same period of time, crossings via other routes, for example, through the Balkans, actually increased. And it would make sense to think that maybe if you're deterring people by entering in one manner, you're just raising the likelihood that they attempt to enter in another. The other reason is that we talk about pull factors, but there's also the question of push factors, right? People leave their countries for a reason, especially asylum seekers. And if you're thinking about deterrence as a sort of cost-benefit analysis on the level of the individual, you know, things would have to be pretty bad in a country that they're attempting to get asylum in for it to be worse than staying in a country that they had to flee.
Are there any international or UN guidelines for immigration policies based on deterrence?
The UN has been pretty clear that deterrence itself is not an appropriate response to asylum seekers, because the whole system of asylum is meant to protect people who need protection. Countries are assigned a responsibility, essentially, to protect them. That said, that type of law is pretty murky. What is less murky, unusually clear, actually, in international law, is the treatment of children and families. The UN Declaration of Human Rights highlights the family unit as something that's important or critical for human rights. And the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which the U.S. is a full party to, gives children the right to legal treatment appropriate to their age. So all of these international instruments deal with this type of policy with respect to children pretty clearly.
Anna Altman is a PhD candidate in political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Students explore MIT's connections to slavery. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Charleston, South Carolina was one of the biggest slave ports in the U.S. This week, the city officially apologized for its role in slavery. And it's far from the only place or institution in the U.S. wrestling with this legacy. Another is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology here in the Boston area. But MIT's reckoning is a departure from what's been done before because it isn't confining its examination to the past. Here's The World's Roopa Shenoy.
Yale, Brown, Harvard, Georgetown, they've all found that they directly benefited from slavery. But all those places were founded in the 16 and 1700s. MIT didn't exist until 2 days before the Civil War, and it was far in the liberal North. So you might not expect there's much to find when it comes to connections to slavery. But MIT professor Craig Wilder just saw that as an opportunity to dig deeper. He's the leading national expert on universities' connections to slavery. And for the sake of keeping things standard in this story, I'll mention he's Black. Wilder didn't want to do MIT's investigation the way other colleges had, with professional historians who issue an official report. So he crafted it as an ongoing class for untrained undergrads, led by teaching assistant Claire Kim.
And I remember Craig telling me, "Claire, it's your class. You can design it however you want." And I thought, oh no, what am I supposed to do?
A small group of us are in a conference room with wood-paneled walls and a high ceiling.
The room we're in right now, this round table, is the classroom that we met regularly in.
Kim's a postdoc studying the history of math, and she's the daughter of Korean immigrants. She decided the new MIT and slavery class had to begin by questioning what was already known of MIT's history.
The official narratives tends to get told as a history of firsts that are primarily white men. It doesn't help that we're sitting in a room where there's a portrait of Albert Einstein, who had never held a position here at MIT, but that kind of the solitary figure reinscribes that, and so we started off with problematizing that from the beginning.
Just 4 students signed up for the class that first semester, fall 2017. Freshman Kelvin Green II, who's Black and was raised in Texas and Virginia, he examined early editions of the school newspaper and yearbook and found images of white students wearing Klan clothing.
Those kind of surprised me because I was like, this isn't in the South. This isn't necessarily the culture of the North.
Charlotte Minsky, a white sophomore from Massachusetts, tracked students from the South who came to MIT to learn about industries that were booming because of slavery.
MIT was a point at which the South and the North interacted. There was a flow of students coming from the South, going back into the South. That fact is important for breaking down this perception that the North, by virtue of its isolation, is somehow exempt from all the implications of slavery, which is perceived as sort of a Southern institution.
The only senior in the class, Alaysia Alexander, looked through early course lists and descriptions. She's from Florida, is Black, and one of her grandfather's grandfathers was a slave. She found things like a class that taught eugenics in the early 1900s and used a textbook that described Black people as dim-witted and brutish. Then Alexander started seeing parallels in her own experience at MIT.
I had an incident with my classmates.
In one of her electrical engineering classes, they were doing a project on Bluetooth, technology created in the 1990s using terminology called the master-slave concept. Like, if you use your phone to operate a speaker, the phone has a master chip and the speaker has a slave chip. Alexander didn't know that when the project started. She missed a meeting where her team discussed it.
So I show up to the next meeting and they go, "Okay, Alaysia, you're going to be on the slave team." And I was like, "I'm sorry?"
She says classmates told her she was overreacting. It was a powerful example for her and her fellow students in the MIT slavery class of how science is still influenced by history. The small class started to feel like a support group. Meanwhile, MIT archivist Nora Murphy, who was helping the students find materials in the archives, she was pursuing her own line of investigation, trying to find out if MIT's founder, William Barton Rogers, owned slaves.
Reading room for the Institute Archives.
Murphy pulls out boxes of documents to demonstrate the trail she followed to eventually discover that Rogers had 6 slaves before moving to Massachusetts. Once Murphy's discovery came out, it kind of overshadowed the students' findings, to their chagrin. This is then-sophomore Charlotte Minsky.
People outside the class, mostly, have really focused in on those revelations. It's very easy to confine slavery to what we perceive as this just like institution that's in its bubble, that's bad, but, you know, is its own thing. But it's not. I mean, it reaches tendrils into every aspect of America, and that means race, that means labor, that means power structures, I mean, it's everything.
The students presented their findings in February to a packed audience.
It's actually riveting. It's fascinating. And it's all here. Just nobody had the time or the interest to look into that.
President L. Rafael Reif, who's originally from Venezuela, started MIT's investigation. And all he said about why is that he got a question about MIT's connections to slavery, and he thought he knew the answer, but he realized he didn't know for sure. At that February event, Reif applauded the students' approach.
If in this case we have the courage to look at even the most unflattering and disturbing parts of our history, I believe we have a much better chance of approaching the present and the future with humility and self-awareness too.
The students were proud of themselves after that event. They felt like they'd been heard. But some people pushed back.
I mean, as soon as our work was publicized, there were comments.
One 1968 MIT graduate wrote an editorial in The Tech, the university newspaper, arguing the MIT and slavery's class's investigation was self-destructive. He said, responsibility for slavery lies with people who are long dead, and we shouldn't judge them or MIT's past by today's morals. A few weeks ago, Minsky and classmate Mahalakshmi Alongo published a long response arguing that separating today's morality from historical morality was just a way to avoid confrontation and discomfort.
I just loved this.
Alicia Alexander reads a passage, smiling at her classmate's work.
It's so great. It's so good.
But the moments that feel like victories don't make confronting the past any easier. I was there as archivist Nora Murphy showed Alexander something she'd found, a program from a big production put on by MIT athletic clubs in 1899.
So I found a program from the show. Yeah. You ready?
Okay.
So that's the athletes and...
She turns the page.
In here we found there's a picture from the production of all of the performers in blackface.
It's a shocking picture of a dozen or so young white athletes in costumes with blackened bodies. A few minutes later, Alexander says she has to go. These moments of coming to terms with MIT's past are emotional, Kelvin Green says, because they resonate so strongly with things that are happening today, things that Green and other members of the Black Student Union are trying to track and document.
There are a lot of current MIT students that are facing really hard times, and so we also have to ask ourselves, is there anything that we're doing now that's falling into the exact same trap of excluding people?
More of those questions might be asked because of the MIT and slavery course. But Green thinks President Reif probably had a more tactical reason for investigating MIT's past.
There have been schools delving into this history, and not only delving into it, but some people calling them out on the fact that they do have this history before they got a chance to do it on their own. So I think, if anything, it was very strategic.
Green thinks MIT was trying to dictate the narrative, and that's okay with him and his classmates, just as long as MIT's narrative includes confronting the ways history still affects students today. For The World, Rupa Shenoy.
I'm Carol Hills. As a teenager in Somalia, Abdi Nor Iftin learned about the U.S. through the words of Donald Trump.
So I read The Art of the Deal, and I thought every sentence that I read was true.
Now, as an immigrant living in Maine, he knows better, and he's written a memoir about his journey and life in Trump's America. That story, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. You might remember a disturbing story from a decade or so ago. It's hard to forget, actually. It was about the systematic torture by members of the U.S. military at the Abu Ghraib prison in Afghanistan. Well, there are reports out now of a similar situation in Yemen, and it's just as disturbing. So if that's a concern, you might want to take a break and tune back in about 5 minutes. The story is this. There's evidence of prisoner abuse by an American ally in Yemen in the war against al-Qaeda. It emerged through testimony from Yemeni prisoners and their families and from former prison guards. But instead of horrific photos to document the alleged torture, this time the pictures were drawn by hand by an alleged victim in what looks like blue magic marker on small plastic plates. We spoke to AP reporter Maggie Michael about one event she documented. It took place in March of this year and allegedly involves interrogators who prisoners say spoke with Emirati accents.
They started to line up the prisoners and take them in group of threes into a room where they ordered them to undress and lay down before they started to do an anal search, searching for cell phones.
I'm sorry, you said they did an anal search, searching for cell phones on these detainees?
Yes, because they believe they have been speaking and communicating with the outside world, with their families and activists and journalists for a few weeks, and they wanted to find out how they're doing this.
And these detainees are Yemenis who've been put in prisons in southern Yemen, and these prisons are run by the United Arab Emirates.
Yes.
And so the United States and the UAE are sort of partners and allies in the war on terror in Yemen. And
yes.
So the importance of this story that you're telling us is because a key U.S. ally is indirectly or possibly directly involved in the torture of detainees.
Yes. The role of and complicity of U.S. has many levels. One level is that their ally is doing the torture. The second level is that there are American interrogators in many of these sites, and the interrogators are taking confessions or testimonies from detainees who were subjected to torture. The third level is there is a possibility that the American interrogators know about what's happening and turning blind eye.
What is the evidence of torture? How did you verify the story?
This is a story that started in 2016. We started at that time speaking to families who were holding demonstrations all the time, searching for their loved ones who disappeared when UAE-backed forces stormed their houses, arrested their kids, and then vanished. When we traveled to Yemen and interviewed former detainees, we spoke to at least 20 of them who gave us testimonies that matched each other about details of how they were tortured, held inside shipping containers, deprived from communicating with the outside world, physically abused, sexually abused on hands of the Emiratis. That was the first part of our investigation.
So you're talking to detainees separately, and they're all telling the same story about what happened. Okay. What is the evidence that there are Americans involved in torture?
This is based on several testimonies by Yemeni officers who were working inside these detention facilities, by prisoners who told us that during interrogations, they heard the guards talking about the Americans. And the third is actually last year, U.S. officials acknowledge that they actually have interrogators on the ground.
So they're acknowledging they have interrogators. But again, what is the evidence that Americans are the ones doing torturing?
We haven't said that the Americans are the ones who did the torture. We confirmed that the Emiratis are the ones who did the torture. In this investigation, we said that the prisoners believe that the Americans know about the torture because they either hear their screams or see marks of torture because they are present inside the same place where the torture takes place.
Why do you find the testimony of the former detainees credible?
I also got information from officials who used to work with the Emiratis, and one of them actually was involved in torture. And this man, along with two others, have defected and turned against the Emiratis and fled the country. And I spoke to them and I got their accounts, and they matched to a great extent what the prisoners said. So I have from two sides, the prisoners and the officials who were involved and were very close to the Emiratis at the time.
What is the U.S. military saying in response to your reporting?
This time, they just dismissed all the reports, and they said they haven't received any solid allegation so they can investigate. But what we know is that there is investigation ongoing right now after the Senate voted in favor of starting this investigation in what is the role of U.S. in torture of detainees in Yemen.
The AP's Maggie Michael. We asked Emirati officials for comment, and they directed us to a tweet from their government. It says Yemeni authorities are in complete control of prison systems and, quote, the UAE has never managed or run prisons or secret detention centers in Yemen. If you're a fan of This American Life, you might remember a story a few years ago about a young Somali man who won the visa lottery to come to the U.S. Here he is describing the moment he got the news.
I put my confirmation number. I put my date of birth. And then click. There was a few seconds of silence. But then, you have been randomly selected. I walked out with these friends, all, you know, shouting behind me, in front of me, you know, holding my hands, shaking me. My heart was bumping.
That's Abdi Noor Iftin. His story was told on This American Life by the world's own Leo Hornack. Now Iftin has a new memoir about his escape from Mogadishu and his changing impressions of his new home in the U.S. It's called Call Me American. In the book, he describes lying on his mother's lap as a child as she told him stories of her youth herding goats and camels. I asked him what the stories meant to him.
They meant everything to me. It was a heroic story. It was a story of strength and perseverance. She would talk about
the animals that she had and how much she loved them. Sometimes I look at myself in America, in Maine, you know, in New York, wherever I am, and how Americans love their dogs. See, they take to the vets, they spend so much money on this animal. And I'm like, you know, I used to say, why do they do this? And then I look back at my mother, I'll say, like, what if there was a vet in Somalia? My mother would take Dranle, which was the camel that was born on the same day that she was born. She loved that camel so much, more than her life. She loved Essay, the goat, so much. So I would be thinking, there you go. This is exactly, I think, what it means. That's why the other world loved their dogs, you know, somewhere else. So mom would talk about those animals and how she misses it and how she misses the smell of the pee from the goats, you know, because she comes to the city and the city people would say, you smell like a pee. And she's like, that's great, isn't it? You know, because that to her, that's a wonderful thing. So she talks about how city is horrible and how people don't understand the value of her animals. And then she talks about the danger. And the danger is the wildlife, the predator, the lion, the hyenas, and how she would, as a little girl, bring a stick with her, go up, you know, into the wilderness with these hundreds of goats. You know, her parents are putting her in charge of bringing these animals out into the safety and bring them all back home with no one missing. And if one is missing, you know, lions or hyenas or something, take one of the goats. She's, you know, she faces the punishment. You know, she gets beaten. So
who,
her job.
Who's she beaten by?
By her dad or her mom. And she was supposed to circle around and stay up all day and jump around and, you know, make all these kind of sounds to scare off the wildlife. So it was a tough job. Walking hundreds of miles every day and you have to come back to the same spot. She was just walking bare feet.
I also want to know about your father. I know in his day he was a well-known basketball player in Mogadishu. Did his stature as this well-known basketball player in the Somali capital help shape your life?
Before the war happened, we were pretty popular in Mogadishu as the basketball family. So, and
was he making a living playing basketball?
He was really making pretty good money. He went out into Iraq and some countries in the Middle East, and he played, and they won, and they came back with medals. So he brought some medals home. And we were part of that, of the Somali family that had food on the table all the time until everything falls apart. And, you know, I find myself watching the guy who we went to buy the snacks from, you know, being sprayed with bullets and his face is down on the ground. So all hell breaks loose.
It's an amazing story because you're growing up, you're a teenager, and you're living this nice life. And then Somalia is swept up in this inter-clan conflict. Give us a before and after snapshot of Mogadishu.
Mogadishu sits on the Indian Ocean coast. It was called the City of Pearl. It was so beautiful. People used to come, and my dad and my mom talked about these Italians and Americans coming to the warm oceans of Mogadishu, you know, in their bikinis running around. It was just so beautiful, and it, you know, it was a commercial route. People from Iran, Turkey, lots of countries in the Middle East.
What about as the war got going? What visually changed?
The war happens very quick. Militias just arrive. Like, everything happens like a movie, right? It happens so fast. Militias come, and they start spraying bullets on the roofs of houses, and they are stealing everything, looting everything. And we're walking down to the other end of the city trying to stay safe, and we stay in this place where a general who's a relative to us was leaving, and the general says, you know what? I'm going to catch the last boat that has to leave. Everything is happening. And then within the same night, the war comes to the same area. And then we flee out of the city into the wilderness, and the war comes to the wilderness. So it's like spreading like a volcano.
What year are we talking about now?
We're talking about in 1991.
Eventually, you manage to leave Somalia and you go to Nairobi, and that's where you win the visa lottery. And it's during that period that you read a paperback by a billionaire, and it's called The Art of the Deal. What did you make of its author?
I loved this person called Trump. I don't know, but I want to tell the audience, actually, I loved him because I didn't see him as a Trump who does not like immigrants. I saw him as an American, and to me, everybody who speaks American English, I thought that Arnold Schwarzenegger, Van Damme, Sylvester Stallone, Eddie Murphy, Denzel Washington, and all these people that I had seen in the movies, to me, were just wonderful and great. I didn't look at them as a Republican or a Democrat. So I read The Art of the Deal. smiling every bit of it. And I thought every sentence that I read was true. And I was like, wow, you know, look at this wonderful, successful story. I read it and I kept that book in a very nice place, even though we lived in a rough life in Nairobi. But we didn't have a shelf, actually. But I left it somewhere under my bed at some point, you know, so that nobody has to steal it, because I had so many friends coming in and out. So I thought he was a wonderful, successful American.
Fast forward many years, and you fight your way through the immigration bureaucracy. You get to America in 2014, and you settle in Maine. It's the whitest state in the U.S., and you start working on a construction crew with a home insulation company. Do your coworkers make you feel welcome?
No, they do not. I kind of found myself in the middle of this tribe, like the Somali tribe, right? At this construction thing, everybody knows everybody else's life. I was this stranger, and they have this Maine accent. They talk about their wives, tattoos, games that they play, wrestling, all of these things that I have no understanding about. When they asked me to say something, I talked about my stories, and they were not interested. This is the part of America that I never thought existed, so I could never blend in, even though I tried as hard as I could. These guys can't even go to Canada because they had been arrested before and they don't have passports and all of this. To me, it was like a gang.
And then what's interesting is you later find out that these construction workers, the guys you were working with, to a person voted for President Trump. Did that have any impact on your relationship with them?
Yes. Kind of Trump showed them the way, right? And Trump comes to Portland, to my city, and he says things about Somalis. And kind of, you know, calling for his supporters in Maine to start thinking that we're evil, we're bad people. You know, that's how it happened. And then there was all of these altercations happening at Walmart to the Somali people, Somali women. And I was freaked out. But then the other thing is, oh, this is it. These guys that I thought a tribe is actually not only a small tribe, it's a larger tribe. It's all over the country. It's from everywhere. They have no understanding on immigrants, and they have no understanding on what we have been through all this time. And they think that we come to the U.S. to steal, to take, but not to accept and be part of it, which is completely not true.
What's next for you, Abdi?
That's a good question. Well, I'm going to college, and I have a future. And believe it or not, even though I'm in my early 30s now, but I feel like I was just born a little less than 4 years ago when I moved to the United States. You know, I'm just trying to catch up and do everything that I can to find education and support my family and eventually be able to bring them over here and have them very close to me, because I'm going to be American, right? But I'm also going to be a world man, you know, someone who's interested in supporting and helping everybody else out there. And I've been a refugee, you know, and I know how hard it is. And I might, you know, be able, when I finish college, and just do something out there as an American, a proud immigrant, a proud Somali, to be able to do something. But most importantly, I will start with my family.
Abdi Nor Iftin has written a memoir. It's called Call Me American. Thank you so much, Abdi.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The year was 1984. The sound was metal. The music was, well, not for all tastes. But the volume?
What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
Yes, up to 11. It's one of the most memorable moments in rock and roll history, even if it was from the spoof rockumentary Spinal Tap. The film followed the fictitious British band on a U.S. tour that didn't quite work out, but rock legends never grow old. Or at least when they do, they put out albums about growing old. That's the case with Harry Shearer's bass-thumping alter ego, Derek Smalls. Smalls has just released a solo album called Smalls Change, Meditations Upon Aging. When we heard that Smalls was touring this summer, we needed to find out about his latest post-Spinal Tap project. Derek Smalls himself joins me now from Los Angeles. Derek, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You know, it's been some time since you were touring with Spinal Tap. Why now and why solo?
Well, we last toured in 2009. It wasn't a tour, really. It was a tour of London. We did the Glastonbury Festival just outside of London, and then we did the Wembley Arena in London. So we basically covered London. And then I thought, here we go. Here's TAP 3.0 or whatever version it might be starting up again. And I was waiting by the telephone and it never rang. And I'm used to that because of the phone service we get. But it turns out that wasn't the problem. It was the band had dissolved again. And so it was at that point that I started thinking about myself as a solitary unit as opposed to a member of something larger. And that's when the idea began.
You know, the really big styles nowadays are not really about guitar heroes or even rock music. Is the genre not dead yet?
It's not dead. It's on life support. And that's what I'm trying to give it a bit of. This record, I'd like to say that it makes up in grandiosity what it may lack in substance, but it goes from prog to metal and hard rock and back. The difference is in the 70s and 80s, rock bestrode the earth like some sort of colossus, in plural, building these musical pyramids in the desert. And it's not like that anymore. And there's a song on the record, as a matter of fact, called When Men Did Rock, which pays tribute to that fact. And by paying tribute, notes that time has passed.
Once 'twas a time when giants walked the earth. They didn't brandish swords and scimitars. No, they won their lasses with basses.
Another song on the record has this lyric in it: rock and roll never forgets, but it sometimes has trouble remembering. And I think that's the moment we're in.
Yeah, I think it perfectly captures it. You know, I've listened to your latest album, and I couldn't help but be left with the thought, why make this?
Well, I could, on the other hand, turn that question around and say, why listen to it? I made it because it's an expression of what, you know, they say, write about what you know. And what I know is I'm getting older. It's a series of thoughts expressed in music about what it's like to get older and still be a rocker. And the audience, you could say, is made up of two different kinds of people: dead people and people who are getting older. And so I'm aiming at the active part of the market and the people, and saying, here's what you're experiencing or what you can look forward to. So dig it.
You know, you've got some heavy hitters playing on this latest album.
Yes.
I mean, Richard Thompson, Donald Fagen, David Crosby, Dweezil Zappa, Peter Frampton, Paul Schaefer. How did you persuade them to be on the album with you?
Well, I persuaded Peter Frampton not to be. But for the rest, it was some of them were friends. Dweezil, Joe Satriani, Steve Lukather had played on as guests on previous Spinal Tap records. For the rest, it was make a call. Hello, it's Derek Smalls. Please return this. And then the second call. Hey, please return them. And a few of those, one of them said it was like a. I'm going to be censoring myself because it's radio here, so I'll only say half the phrase. He said, "Yeah, man, it's like a pity blank." And I thought, I'm going to take that as a compliment. It's the right way to take anything is as a compliment, I think.
Yeah. Now, you know, there's been some big changes in music and culture since Spinal Tap was out there rocking stadiums with songs like Big Bottom. How do you feel that Spinal Tap's music has aged? I mean, especially in this Me Too moment.
Well, it's interesting you say that. In the live show that I've been doing, we have a female performer. It's a reckoning moment, we say. And we have a female performer who's very much the spitting image of, if spitting were allowed in a theater, of Dame Shirley Bassey, who comes out and does her Me Too version of a Spinal Tap classic. And it starts with these words, "Welcome to my sex farm." So we've been able to, you know, turn it around a bit.
I think that's really owning it. I think that's, you're right in the spirit of the moment there.
Well, it's at least renting it.
Yeah. Derek Smalls, thanks for making time for us. And if you do happen to run into Harry Shearer, please give him our best.
Will do. Thank you.
Derek Smalls there. He's the bassist alter ego of satirist, actor, and voiceover artist Harry Shearer. Spinal Tap, Derek Smalls, who knows how kind history will be to them, but this song has certainly stood the test of time. Yes, That's Drive My Car, of course, from the 1965 Beatles album Rubber Soul. It's been covered and remixed who knows how many times over the years, but never like the latest version. It started with an idea from our own Marco Werman and ended up like this. This version of Drive My Car is in Arabic. It's a rework by a group of Middle Eastern students at the Berklee College of Music right here in Boston. And it's not just for fun. There's a news peg here, too. The idea was to mark the beginning of a new era in Saudi Arabia. This weekend, women there will be able to drive legally for the first time. Marco spoke with a couple of the musicians with the project.
What is this song called in Arabic?
It's called Rahsu' al-Sayyara.
And that translates as what?
I will drive the car.
It's a statement of fact.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
The main idea is that this female who's singing just got the ability to drive. She's really excited, and at this moment of her life, she really doesn't care about anything else. She's getting all these proposals from different men. They're promising her all these things, but she's like, at the moment, I just want to drive, and maybe later I will love you, maybe later I will think about these things, but at the moment, I just want to drive this car.
More on that story tomorrow. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills.
PRI, Public Radio International.